middle name, and it's getting ever harder for me. Our first session, as you know, is on Obama's first year in office, the Obama administration. Our year is on Obama's world. We're starting a little late. Our program is not yet complete. There seems to have been some problem with the budget. I may be connected somehow with an economic or fiscal crisis somewhere around here, I think. But we seem to be okay for the minute. As we always do, we give a little idea of what's coming up. So you know, our next session, and we have a kind of truncated winter, but the spring quarter will be quite full. Our next session is 1 month from today, actually 4 weeks. It's on March 1st, called Trading Places, China and the U.S. in the International System, which is going to be co-sponsored with the Center for Chinese Studies, with Barry Naughton, School of International Relations from UC San Diego, and Richard Baum from the Department of Political Science right here at UCLA. We've got a couple others which I should mention. On April 5th, the Future of California Public Higher Education, which is co-sponsored with the Institute on Labor and Employment. So far, Chris Newfield from the Department of English, UC Santa Barbara, coming. He's written a whole lot of really interesting stuff on this subject, probably leading authority on this today, and we're very happy to have him. And then the next one that we know is taking place is on 20th of May on climate change after Copenhagen. It's co-sponsored with the Institute of the Environment and the Buerkle Center for International Relations. Main speakers, Stephen Schneider from Stanford, the Woods Institute for the Environment, and Matt Kahn right here from the Institute of the Environment at UCLA, also Economics Department. So that's what we know. Hopefully, I'm pretty sure we will fill that out. And if you need to find out anything about what's going on with our center, you can check with emailing or phoning through our office. Now, or speak with Tom Mertes there. That's the way to make it happen. Okay, or anything happen around our center. So we have three terrific presenters, and I'm really not going to give them the kinds of introductions that they deserve, because if I did, we wouldn't have enough time for them to speak. So I'm going to not give these elaborate introductions, which one might do, especially for our first presenter, who is Joyce Appleby, who's everyone knows, and for which reason I will just say that she's been the president of the Organization of American Historians, president of the American Historical Association, written many books, Capitalism and the New Social Order, Liberalism and Republicanism and the Historical Imagination, and most recently just came out, The Relentless Revolution, A History of Capitalism. So Joyce, without further ado, thank you.
Thank you, Bob. It's always nice to be able to talk about a subject that hasn't been discussed much. When Bob asked me to participate on this panel with two princes of punditry, I was really puzzled. Why would they add me? And then I realized it must be because of my background in American history. He wanted me to dig into the 43 previous presidencies and find some comparisons of Obama's first year with, say, the first year of Millard Fillmore or Chester Arthur. Now, Chester Arthur, as it turns out, has figured a story about him, has figured in my own personal history with presidencies, helping me get through many an awful Wednesday morning after a particular election. Arthur, as you no doubt recall, came into the presidency after President James Garfield had been assassinated 2 months into his presidency. Arthur was a regular old New York Pole who had been rewarded for his efforts with the commissionership of the New York City Port Authority. When one of his Republican colleagues heard that Garfield had been assassinated, he exclaimed, "My God, Chet Arthur, president." Well, I know that feeling. But I'm not going to say anything more about Arthur, because I want to talk about the anger that has possessed some of our electorate and seems to be like a black cloud hovering over the run-up to the congressional elections. Where does this anger come from? Is it susceptible to analysis? If not, can it be grasped with analogies? Part of this strong feeling can be attributed to the disappointment that of what Obama hasn't done. Americans well know that candidates promise things that they can't do. But the problem with Obama was that people believed him. As they boarded the plane called Hope in 2008, they felt like they were participating in a magical moment, supporting not just the first African-American candidate, but a poor waif challenging a princess who was already measuring the throne. They were helping a promising young man who, as David Brooks quipped, loves the future because that's where all of his accomplishments are. But it wasn't just the wonder of electing Obama that long ago Tuesday night. It was feeling that everything was going to change. With wit, generosity, intellect, grace, and charisma, the new president was going to unload all the baggage of the past and usher in a new era. Looking back, this now indicates to me that Democrats and independents who converted to Obama still believed in Santa Claus. Or perhaps a better analogy is that the voters are suffering from buyer's remorse. Independents were promised an era of bipartisanship and got tea parties instead. Civil libertarians believed that Obama would reject Bush's use of executive power to hold prisoners indefinitely, only to hear the old refrain about national security. Good government types expected transparency, and instead they had to watch the White House deal-making during the health care reform effort. And there are many more pools of disappointment. As Gail Collins teased, seldom have so many been angry for so many different reasons. Another way to capture the public mood today might be that of falling out of love. All of a sudden in 2008, American sodden politics began to take on a golden shimmer. We felt different because we lived in a finer world. We acted better because reform beckoned. Then slowly, as these things tend to do, the old familiar gray skies return. No more heady days. Just a steady diet of wisdom from Mac Baucus, Ben Nelson, Mitch McConnell, Jim DeMint, Joe Lieberman. How had these guys escaped Cupid's arrow? This disappointment, rage, acrimony is all the more perplexing because this has been a fine first year by any non-emotional yardstick. Every one of the executive departments has shifted from indifferent to competent hands to men and women who believe that the Federal Department of Land Management ought to manage the land for the public good, that the Pure Food and Drug Administration should protect the public from toxic elements in our water bottles, that it's sound policy to support birth control around the world and raise fuel standards for cars. When it looked like the health care bill would go through, presidential historian Robert Dallas called it a miracle, given the razor-thin majority to vote for cloture in a filibuster-prone Senate. And he still may achieve it. But without the handsome majorities enjoyed by Jefferson, Jackson, Lincoln, Teddy, and Franklin Roosevelt when they embarked on bold programs, Obama has shepherded through Congress a stimulus plan, a Supreme Court nomination. He's beginning re-regulation of the financial system and has new initiatives to counter global warming. And that stimulus plan had within it a number of bills for funding for children's health, land conservation, expanding broadband coverage. Then on the international front, Obama so charmed the International Committee with his peace offensive that the Nobel Committee awarded him a prize, even though he increased drone attacks in Pakistan and Yemen and tripled the number of U.S. troops in Afghanistan. Still, while initiating a virtual whirlwind of presidential action, Obama has had to watch almost helplessly as the sands of hope have dropped through the hourglass into the bottom of despair, one sinking disappointment after another. With last month's trifecta of Scott Brown's victory, the Supreme Court liberation of corporations, and the demise of Air America, media analysts have agreed that for the Democrats, this has been a wake-up call, an omen, a fire belt in the night, an early warning signal, a jolt from complacency, a stun gun hit, an alert, a portent, a brush with disaster, a harbinger, a tea leaf reading, a dead canary in the mine shaft, or possibly a preview of coming distractions. I assume that in wanting to talk about Obama's administration after the first year, there is some concern about Obama going forward. Addressing this topic now brings to mind an old agrarian practice. After the wheat crop had been harvested in the old days, the poor were left into the fields to pick up any grains that had fallen to the floor, to the ground. After 2 weeks of intensive commentary on what Obama should do next, it's hard for me not to feel like one of those gleaners. Unless I go a metaphor too far, I'd say that we analyzers are reading from palimpsests, in which beneath the lines of what we are now proposing lies the script for what we said originally that Obama should do. And I have to confess to that. I actually had a great list of recommendations for Obama, but unfortunately stole them all last Wednesday from his address to Congress. I liked his proposal for stimulating the economy by linking good jobs to national pride and recovering first place in information technology and green energy and educational elements, and the maintenance of world-class transportation and communication systems. Of course, the speech was captivating, but I am post-infatuation. I want to see him get this program through, and I don't think he can do so without poking a sacred cow of American politics. Thomas Friedman recently called for Obama's launching his own moonshot, and in his breathless gee-whiz style, which I like and I agree with him, he called for mobilizing 1 million new startup companies that will create lasting, good-paying jobs, pushing innovation that will make people more productive, more entertained, and healthier. And then just a few columns over on the same page, Frank Rich went for much the same positive response, but cautioned, there's no chance of a second stimulus. Why? Because of the bogey of the national deficit. To say that the national deficit is a bogey is to provoke a quick intake of breath, because we have all become convinced of the irrevocable damage of our large indebtedness. We see our Gulliver Obama tied down by 1 million IOUs held by China and others. Still, he can't reverse the negative economic trends of a quarter century without something equivalent to a moonshot, and he can't proceed without one without defanging the threat of increased government spending. The New York Times recently referred to the perception that the government is spending is out of control. That perception has to be the target of Obama's talks to the public this year. But it will be very much like, say, balancing an elephant on the end of a baton. Of course, the long-range damage of high deficits must be acknowledged. Cutting the federal bureaucracy by 10% isn't a bad idea. Discriminating between effective and ineffective programs makes sense, but the larger point needs to be made forcefully. We can't reverse this job glut without more stimulus. The phony issue of the debt needs to be hit head-on. Instead of responding to the fear that Republicans have stirred up, Obama needs to explain the difference between long-term deficits, which something like health care reform would address, and deficits in the short run, in the near term, where an increase is now needed. Republicans showed no interest in reducing the debt when they were in power. They blew right through Clinton's surplus. The debt for them is a bludgeon to be used against federal programs, however urgently needed. A strong historical argument can be made for minimizing the importance of the federal deficit in the short run. The last time the American debt represented this large a share of GDP was in 1948, on the threshold of the longest period of prosperity in American history. With that prosperity, the IRS enjoyed a swelling revenue in the 1950s and a gain that was sufficient to shrink that deficit, just as we would now with the creation of millions of well-paying debts. The issue of the deficit and good jobs is linked. People who earn the minimum wage pay very few taxes. The IRS has lost billions because of employers like Walmart. The almost 2 million Walmart workers who get an average of $10 an hour pay almost half as much as the Costco workers who are paid an average of $17 an hour. There isn't a lot of strong evidence that independents have long been worried about federal deficits. Did they say anything in the 80s? They're reacting to the Republicans' fear-mongering. Republicans have adroitly turned the government's debt into a focal point for the diffuse anger abroad in the land. This anger has two demographic components, at least. The annus horribilis of 1973 brought American stagflation, soaring gas prices, sliding union membership, along with the ascent of Walmart. Stagnation in wages followed stagflation, and the inequality gap that had narrowed during the previous 25 years began to widen again. For those suffering from these malign forces, anger has been a slow burn. More recently, the collapse of the real estate boom has added to the pool of discontent. In the 1990s, millions of homeowners used their rising home equity as a savings account for financing tuition, home improvements, vacations, and cars. Now their mortgages are underwater, their IRAs have shrunk, and they're mad. Both these groups need to hear from the president about the paths away from this 30-year trend, as well as immediate measures to prevent another financial collapse. The revival of preeminence for America's battered economy, not just jobs, should be the theme of the 2010 elections, and those Democrats running for Congress need to be convinced that Obama's prescriptions will work for them. One of the rare occasions when a president's first congressional election saw a net gain for his party was in 1934, when FDR garnered 9 additional House members and an astonishing 9 new Senate seats for his party. Roosevelt achieved this victory with a bold, innovative, and costly program right in the middle of the Depression. That initiative, of course, was Social Security, a proposal that he knew would be like a red flag waved in the face of his opponents. They charged, and the president took his case to ordinary American men and women who regularly listened to his radio talks. Like Obama, Roosevelt has foes on the left, too, in particular the wily Senator Huey Long of Louisiana. Long launched his Share Our Wealth Society in a preliminary bid for the presidency. Roosevelt played his enemies off against each other, positioning his Social Security plan between Long's crackpot scheme to soak the rich and the business community's adamant rejection of the safety net. Obama is not FDR, and 2010 is not 1934, but the need for the president to hold on to his majority is as urgent now as it was then. The president's first year has had successes. Many a foundation has been laid for programs in the years ahead. But as Charles Lowe concluded wryly, now the emperor has no cloture. With a little more moxie, he might get it back. At the very best, at least, I think, we are witnessing the beginning of an effort to paint the Republicans into the corner of partisan politics. Everyone wants Obama to act. Robert Reich wants him to act. I do too. But we shouldn't discount the possibility that he may have a game plan that none of us can imagine. Thanks.
Thank you very much.
Our next presenter is Michael Lind, who is Policy Director at the New America Foundation's Economic Growth Program. Michael was a natural to invite for our first session because he was here a couple years ago to help us kick off our